I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Our next guest has written these words, which I think are crucial to our quality of life. Just listen to this. Many people have favorite places in nature, spots they are fond of that form a part of their identity. It is vital to preserve these. To lose a place like that is to lose a little of oneself. Do you happen to have such a place? A place in nature that is inextricably part of your personal identity? I'm actually very glad that the quote isn't just about one place. She's actually used the plural. She's written about many people having favorite places in nature. I think I have dozens and dozens, and yes, they have shaped my identity. I'm going to spare you a list because you've got your list. I have mine. We're all in this together. Anna Sverdrup Tygesen is one of Norway's best-known voices as an educator about the workings of nature. She specializes as a conservation biologist at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. She talks about a range of things in the life sciences, but with a focus on insects, biodiversity, and nature management. Her most recent book, titled Tapestries of Life, Uncovering the Life-Saving Secrets of the Natural World. Anna Sverdrup Tygesen, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much.
When I think about your work, and I think about the audiences today, are you finding people who want to hear what you have to say? Are you finding them in greater numbers than maybe a decade ago?
Yes, actually, I think I do. I think there is sort of an awakening going on. People are hungry for more knowledge about nature, about biodiversity, certainly here in Norway, but I think also in all over the world, really, because we start to understand that this biodiversity is absolutely vital for our lives. It's the basis for our societies, and we really need to know more about it to be able to take care of it.
And you come prepared with so many stories. I scarcely know where to begin, but let's stay kind of autobiographical for a moment here with your own background. How did you find yourself attracted in the first place to studying nature, the life sciences?
Well, actually, I started out studying history. And then after a year of history, I switched to biology. And I think I've always been fond of nature and always been, my family used to spend a lot of time in the outdoors. And I had very patient adults around me that would answer my never-ending questions of how everything sort of fit together, why things were the way they were. But I didn't really realize in the beginning that you could actually, you know, study biology and make a living out of these things. It was just sort of my life. But then as I switched to biology, I understood that maybe the same that fascinated me by history, this sort of link between the small details and the bigger, broader picture is exactly what fascinates me in ecology as well. How species interact, how things fit together. I just think that's so, I mean, you can get blown away when you start to learn about these intricate connections in nature.
Yeah, I am so glad you've said this because I think that the stories about nature that connect sort of the micro world with the macro world, those stories seem so incredibly important if you're talking about insects and then connecting the dots all the way up to what happens in, you know, the entire Amazonian region, you know. That are those stories hard to tell, to explain to people how to connect those dots from the very, very small to the very, very large issues?
I think you have to spend a bit of time on sort of forming, shaping the stories to make it simple enough to people to sort of get the point. Because of course it's super complicated if you dive into the details. But then again, I think it works quite well if you are conscious about using sort of the fascination and using examples and metaphors that people are familiar with, and you focus on telling people why, what's in it for you? Why is this important for you? And then people can connect quite easily, I find.
Yeah, well, let's get into one of those stories very specifically. People care a lot about their honey not being blue. There's a story from France where all of a sudden people were finding, the beekeepers were finding blue honey. Would you tell us that story?
Yes, it's sort of a fun story in a way, but with a more serious message underneath. Some years back, the beekeepers in France, they peered into their hives and they realized that instead of golden honey, they had blue or green honey in the honeycombs. That didn't look very nice and it wasn't very easy to sell. I mean, you couldn't sell it. So they started to investigate why this blue honey. And it turned out that in the vicinity of these beehives, there was a biogas facility, and it was storing waste material from a factory producing M&Ms. You know, those brightly colored chocolate-covered peanuts that pretty much all Americans would know about. And this sugary waste material was stored outdoors. So the honeybees probably thought that they had found an amazing and very strange flower. So they went to this waste material and brought it back, sugar and color and everything, back into the hive instead of, you know, flying between the apple trees doing their job. And this was the reason why the honey turned into these sort of ghastly colors, at least for honey. Fortunately, once they found the source and had identified this problem, the factory would move all the raw material indoors. And with that, the French honey regained its golden hue again.
When I hear that story, it actually reminds me of going to, say, a national park where signs are posted saying, please do not feed the wildlife. And I'm wondering if you could comment on those kinds of disruptions to the natural relationships between, say, animals and their food sources.
Yes, I think this is a good example why you shouldn't put out, you know, feeders with sugary water for pollinators, because it actually draws them away from both the job they're supposed to do, collecting the nectar in places where they at the same time would pollinate flowers. And also, whatever sugary water we can put out is nothing but a shadow of the true stuff. I mean, nectar contains a lot of ingredients that also play a part in the life of these insects. So rather make your garden into a place with a wealth of flowers of different kinds, with lots of pollen and nectar, than sort of resorting to this feeding approach. So your parallel is a good example. It goes the same for pollinating insects.
Again, we're going from something big to something small to something big, because at the national parks, people are thinking, well, I'm not supposed to put out food that a bear would eat or even a squirrel would eat. Very few of us would ever think about somehow intervening in the life of a tiny insect, you know?
In most cases, people either don't think about insects at all, or if they do, a lot of people hate them. So, I mean, they really have a PR problem, these tiny species. But they are super, super important. I mean, they are so numerous and they come in so many varieties. Because if you talk about biodiversity, insects is such a big part of it. We know that out of the plants and animals that we have described today, insects make up more than 75%. Whether you like them or not, we really should care about them and take better care of them. Because if they go, we will certainly go.
When you say 75%, are you talking in terms of the number of species, or are we talking in terms of sort of the biomass, the cumulative weight of all insects in the world?
The first, definitely. 75% of all this plant and animal species. If you talk about biomass, on the other hand, then the plants would definitely win. They would make up about 80% of the biomass on the planet, according to the most recent estimates. So they are definitely the winners in biomass. And it's fascinating then to think of all the connections between the plants and the insects, because that is a world of its own, like with the pollinators.
As long as we're talking about pollinators, you know, the poster child for pollinators, the one that people really think are cute and cuddly, are butterflies. And then next in line, people think about bees. And yet, very few people are acquainted, in my experience, with the idea of flies as pollinators. And that's a huge story.
Yes, because like you're saying, there are so many different insects taking part in pollination, and that's important because they do slightly different jobs when they pollinate, and they can do it in different sorts of climates and conditions. Flies, especially the flower flies or hoverflies, they are super important in pollination. Probably some people have seen them, and maybe they have even thought that this was a wasp of some kind, a yellow jacket, because it disguises as one. Most of the hoverflies have these yellow and black stripes, but it's easy to separate them if you watch them for a minute. And if the insect you're watching can do the trick of hovering in the air like a hummingbird, seemingly motionless in front of a flower, then it is a hoverfly, because a yellow jacket could never do that. None of the wasps, the Hymenopterus, can do that. These hoverflies use this skill to suck nectar from flowers. This actually has a huge impact. There is a study, for instance, from UK, saying that each spring there's at least a billion hoverflies that come speeding across the channel from France and the continent over to the UK. And they do a super important job, not just because these hoverflies, the adult ones, they pollinate and they also bring a cargo of exotic pollen, which is good to get more diversity, but also the young hoverflies, their larvae, they are really hungry predators, and they can eat in just an estimation more than 6,000 metric tons of aphids in a summer in the UK alone. So here you have a species that really plays into the ecology of your garden in several ways.
Yeah, I'm feeling just a little bit speechless, because these are very small insects, and I just don't even know how they'd hazard a journey across the English Channel. You know, are they migratory? I wouldn't even think they have a very long lifespan.
The adults don't live for that many weeks, but yes, they are migratory. And I guess people in the US are familiar with the monarch butterfly, which is one of the most known insects that, you know, migrate for long distances. But there are several more. And flies actually can also migrate, and dragonflies can migrate, and many different species fly longer than we think, often helped by the high winds. But these are things we often know very little about, because, I mean, we don't see them up there. Sometimes they use flight radar and they see these flocks that they don't really know what it is. And then if you have some way of sampling it, you realize it's actually insects on the flight.
I've heard about that, the idea that they'll pick up on, well, here's a wave of something moving, and they find out it's not birds, it's smaller than that. You know, that's just stunning.
Yes, it is.
Would you address this notion that I've come across more recently? I should have known about this, I suppose, for years, but there are relationships between I'll just say insects, pollinators, for instance, and certain plants that are so specialized that the insect is dependent upon that particular type of plant, and without that plant, the insect won't survive, and without those insects, the plants won't reproduce. I guess this is a story of evolution and kind of a codependency.
Yes, and there are some really bizarre stories of those types of connections. And I mean, one example is the pollination of Brazil nuts, these nuts that you will eat for food. At least in Norway, we often eat them around Christmas for some strange reason. I don't really know why, but I mean, they are used a lot for human consumption. And these Brazil nuts come from huge trees, and the flowers of these trees are pollinated by some insects that are, I mean, if you can imagine tiny jewels with wings on, that's pretty much what we're talking about. These are called orchid bees, and they are just stunningly beautiful. Really, I mean, look them up on the web. They are so beautiful. And the females of the orchid bees, They are in charge of the pollen transport between the Brazil nut flowers. And that is really tricky because these flowers have a sort of a lid to them, and these female orchid bees, they need to sort of lift that and squeeze past it. And in that way, they pollinate the trees. But that's just half of the story. Because in order to have orchid bees, they, of course, also need to mate. And the female orchid bees, they are choosy in a way. They will only mate with an orchid bee male that smells good, in her opinion. The male orchid bee has to make his perfume himself. And he does that by flying between different orchids, gathering different kinds of sweet-smelling oils. And these he stores in a strange structure on his hind legs, sort of a container shaped by his leg plates. And I mean, practically speaking, it is a perfume bottle on his leg. And this is needed to have the female interested, to make the female interested in actually being mated. And at the same time, this male, of course, will ensure the pollination of the orchids. So it's like a sort of a three-way connection here between the orchids, the Brazil nut trees, and the orchid bees, which is also then in the end very beneficial for us humans by providing these Brazil nuts for local populations and for the export market.
We are going to jump in just a moment from the story of things like Brazil nuts and orchid bees to the water system of New York City, which is a crazy jump in some ways, and yet it all fits together. I just, while you were talking, you said, look it up. And I did. I looked on the internet at orchid bees. Those things are more colorful than Mardi Gras, than Carnival. They are brightly colored little creatures. We're going to continue our conversation with Anna Sverdrup-Tygesen. She is author of Tapestries of Life, Uncovering the Life-Saving Secrets of the Natural World. I want to ask you now, moving away from the insects and the Brazil nuts, New York City's water system. When I learned this detail from you, I was just shocked to think that such a metropolitan area has unfiltered water, tap water.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, isn't it? And this is all because nature can clean the water for us for free if you just sort of leave it to do what nature is supposed to do. It's a really fascinating story. I thought about this 2 years ago now. I was in New York in connection with my previous book, Extraordinary Insects, and I was out running in Central Park in the early in the morning, and I just had to stop and taste this water because it's supposed to be, you know, the champagne of drinking water. It's a work of nature. The fascinating thing is that in the 1990s, when the U.S. federal authorities passed this new legislation, setting stricter requirements for purification of drinking water, the New Yorkers were thinking that they had to build a treatment facility that would cost in the region of $4 billion, and with huge annual operating budgets, it would lead to a doubling in the city's water bills. But then someone thought that there is an alternative here. And they initiated a unique collaboration between the New York City and the municipalities and the landowners in the watershed, the huge, huge area north of New York City, where the water is sort of collected from rainwater, right? So they organized, they set this up so that large forest and wetland areas would be left undeveloped. Those areas that were developed would be cultivated in environmentally friendly methods. And in this way, the water treatment facility was unnecessary because natural processes and all these species in the ecosystem, the mosses, the insects, the plants, the trees, they did the job of cleaning this water for free. And even though there was a cost of course, buying these lands and making these agreements, the cost was much, much a fraction of the cost of running a facility and building it. And at the same time, you had the added value of securing this land as a habitat for biodiversity and as a resource for recreation and outdoor activities. I actually went straight from, when I was done in New York City, we went up to these watershed areas and hiked, and it's a beautiful area. It was really amazing. I was up at the sunset in Ampersand Mountain and thought about these connections. And again, I think nature is so amazing if we just sort of leave it, leave the capabilities of letting nature do what it's supposed to do, what it has done for, you know, billions of years before we came along. So we should sort of pay more attention to nature's goods and services that we are so lucky to sort of gain from.
I was speaking with a friend of mine just a couple of weeks ago about his concern about the purity of certain foods that he was eating. And he was talking about trying to source a kind of tea that would not contain heavy metals. And I just kind of blurted out and said to him, you know, we're all filters. And it's you're talking about water filtration in New York City and the way they did not have to build a huge filtration plant. But so many life forms seem to perform functions like this, whether it's, say, oysters or mussels that are they're cleaning out water, or different types of plants or kelp, or but even a human body with every breath, with everything I consume, water or food, things are going into my body, and for good or evil, you know, my body is a filter, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. Like you say, like all living organisms will, you know, you have to have some sort of nutrients into your body, and then some of it you can use and some of it you can't use, and some of that might not be so good for you. And of course, these are challenges that we are facing today, because we humans have had such a huge effect on the entire planet. There is really no spot left that can be sort of said to be true wilderness. You know, climate change is affecting absolutely all parts of the globe. Also long distance transported pollution of different kinds is affecting. I mean, even the polar bear, you know, is affected by long distance pollution in addition to climate change. And I think some of these things are quite scary. I mean, we don't have to be hysterical about these things, but we should rather use this as a motivation to appreciate that we are dependent on a functioning nature, and that we should not, you know, make it too difficult by polluting or by climate change or with our use intensive land use. We shouldn't make it too difficult for all these 10 million species we share the planet with to go on doing their business, so that we can gain from it and live happy lives together, sharing this planet with these 10 million species. It's possible, but it needs a bit more conscious effort, I think, than we are maybe doing today.
So that conscious effort, in my view, and I expect you're going to agree with this, but we'll see, you know, that conscious effort has got to be more than just theoretical thinking about it. I think people got to get outdoors and be with plants and animals. I mean, spending a lot more time out there. I don't think without investing that kind of time, these thoughts, these theories can really grow and develop.
Yeah, no, I agree completely, because how can we take care of nature if we're not familiar with it? It's actually a saying in the Bible that says something that what your heart is filled with, your mouth will speak. I don't know exactly how it's said in English, but that's the essence of it. And I mean, this sort of frames this idea that if you know something, you love it, you like it, you appreciate it, then you will also talk about it and engage in taking care of it. And I mean, how can we expect our children to do a better job of saving climate and nature than we have done if we don't teach them to sort of see and appreciate nature and all these fellow creatures that we share the planet with?
I want one more specific story from you, and I'm going to let you pick. Would you like to talk about mangrove forests? Those are amazing. Or something that I'd never heard of before, hook mosses.
Oh, let's do the mangrove forests then, because that's maybe not on a, maybe more on an international level. And it's related to the same thing. It's related to the fact that many plants and trees do services that we gain from. And as people might know, a mangrove is a name to several species of trees and also to the forest they shade on the edge of dry land and salt water. So mangrove trees and mangrove forests, they link these two different habitats, and they are like a protective, a living protective belt, cushioning the land against tsunamis, flood water, and wind. And the mangrove forests in the world have shrunk dramatically. Only about 60% is left, so 40% has gone. And this means that we are losing the capacity to curb the impact of extreme events along the coast, which is something we really don't want. And studies from Southeast Asia, from tsunamis and other events there, show that even if we try to imitate this effect by making constructions, it doesn't work as well as the natural solution. It's more expensive, but it's also less effective. So coastal villages with intact mangrove forests, they have fewer fatalities, less loss of human lives, and less damage to infrastructure than villages where this mangrove forest has been removed and replaced with a breakwater or a dike of some sort. So again, we need to appreciate these services. I think it's worthwhile going out in a place in nature, one of these sites maybe that you started talking about, a place you appreciate in nature, and you can sit down and just be quiet for a second and think about the amazing fact that we are just one species among 10 million living here on this only place in the universe where we know that life exists. And at the same time, we humans are unique because we can interact in a way that both makes us have a huge impact on the entire planet and every other species, but we also have this capacity to evaluate our actions in a logical and moral perspective. And I think that if you sit down in nature and think about this, you realize that with this insight comes also a great responsibility. And I would argue that it is time for us to shoulder that responsibility, because nature is all we have and all we are.
I just want to know, given the idea that people have their special places they like to go in nature and that form their identity, that help shape their identity, if you had a day off, your next day off, and if you were at liberty to go wherever you wanted to one of your places, can you describe that place to us?
Oh, that would be an old growth forest for sure. It really does something very special to me. I mean, it's tall, it's old. You know that these systems store large amounts of carbon. You can stand there, think about the, you know, the carbon dioxide that I breathe out is built into these amazing trees, these organisms that live for hundreds and hundreds of years. They turn into dead trees. In the dead trees, you find about a third of all the species that live in a forest. And they do this job of recycling. It's, for me, a symbol of the entire circle of life, how life and death is tied together, and how all these organisms make it work. And I have some favorite spots in my forest close to where I live. But I also, like I write about in the book, if there's one place in the U.S. where I know I need to go back to, it's the redwood forests up north in California. It's the most amazing place I've been in the entire world, actually. A symbol of all this. These feelings of being part of something amazing, something so much bigger and longer lasting than my short life. yeah, people have these places and use them. And I would encourage everyone listening to, yeah, to spend some time the next day off, go out and sit down and think for a while about this, these small and big issues and how we all fit into it all, we humans and you and me as separate individuals.
You know, when I have the privilege of meeting somebody like you, I just can hardly stand to say goodbye. And so so I do have one last question for you. You said something about the carbon dioxide that you exhale that is taken in by the tree. When you're in one of these places, are you actually having these kinds of thoughts about your personal connection to something like a tree in an old growth forest?
Yes, I do. Not in a sort of new agey way, if that's a term that can be used, but on a sort of a mix of a scientific level, because we are tied together. I mean, it's a fact that the carbon dioxide that we humans and all other animals will breathe out is taken up by plants and trees, and that's what make, you know, the huge enormous trunks that make up, for instance, the redwood forest or another forest. But also, I think it touches me on a much deeper level, something very basic that I think is maybe ingrained in us humans up through all these hundreds of thousands of years that we have existed. We, you know, this what is called biophilia, the love of biodiversity and nature, which E.O. Wilson speaks so well about. This is part of evolution as well. We have lived and evolved and in close connection with other species, and we still have this in us. I just think it's maybe a bit buried today, because if you live to be 100, you will have spent 90 of those years inside a building or a car. This gives us fewer opportunities to strengthen this bond with nature and with biodiversity.
Anna Sverdrup-Tygesen, a pleasure to visit with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Anna Sverdrup-Tygesen is author of Tapestries of Life, Uncovering the Life-Saving Secrets of the Natural World.
That was Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. When human settlements bump up against wild animals, we humans usually dominate. But coming up, we have a win-win story where creative thinkers look to honeybees to mediate a standoff between humans and elephants. That's next on Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. If you want to save the elephants, as I think most of us would like to, we're going to have to figure out how to save the humans too. Well, or at least the livelihood of the humans who live near elephants. Because if the two species can't live side by side, then something's got to give. The answer, oddly enough, may lie in the tiny honeybee. Marcus Smith got the story from Lucy King. King is the head of the Human-Elephant Coexistence Program for Save the Elephant.
My research is focused on a folklore, and this is stemming from a traditional African folklore. I live and work in Kenya, and it's a Kenyan folklore that we found out about, that elephants were scared and would avoid honeybees. And this is such an interesting idea. We learned about this from people working up in the remote parts of northern Kenya. And they had hives that they would put up into trees that elephants were particularly, you know, favorite trees that elephants would eat. But they wouldn't touch the trees which had beehives in. And this sort of discovery that elephants weren't foraging on trees with beehives in was the start of my PhD work. And I spent many years up in northern Kenya living in a tent trying to understand the behavior of African elephants and how they reacted to African honeybees.
Is the African honeybee you're talking about a really aggressive kind of a creature?
Yes. So the African honeybee is the original honeybee from Africa that was brought over to South America and interbred with the European honeybee. And that hybrid bee is what your Africanized honeybee is that's in North America now and causing all sorts of problems. We're actually dealing with the original African honeybee, but it certainly is as aggressive, and it's no joke to be stung by an African honeybee.
This sounds like a major complication to the story you're about to tell us about using bees to ward off elephants. I think maybe the best door to go through now would have to do with the conflict, the human-elephant conflict, and how serious that has been. Could you describe what the rub has been?
That's right. So I head up the human-elephant coexistence program for Save the Elephants, and we are fundamentally looking at a growing and increasing challenge for Africa. That is that our elephant populations are becoming more and more concentrated into smaller habitat zones as the human population is expanding. Not only is it expanding, but the level and quality of life is expanding. So there's more infrastructure, there's more schools, there's more houses, there's more roads, railways, pipelines coming in. And elephant habitat is being more and more condensed and squashed. But what's happening is because elephants need so much land for forage, for food, for finding mates, they are exploring and continuing to use old migration routes, irrelevant of if a new community has grown up or a new school or a new farm. So we're seeing the barrier between elephants and people being broken down by this concentration of elephants into habitat zones. And we're seeing a massive increase in human-elephant conflict. And that conflict is what I'm really interested in studying. The conflict is the moment when elephants meet people. And that can be in the form of property, but it more typically it's dealing with farmland because elephants are looking for food and people are growing food right in the area where elephants always used to migrate. And they're coming across these beautiful farms, and of course, they're starting to forage on crops, and it's causing this huge conflict. And people retaliate. You know, they can either throw stones or sticks or fire at elephants, but more likely it escalates where the farmers and communities start to throw things like arrows and spears, and worst case scenario, of course, gunshots and killing the elephant. So it really can escalate very quickly. And of course, tragically, elephants can kill people as well. So this is a very negative situation. And we're trying to find holistic methods to keep elephants out of people's farms, which doesn't necessarily rely on a huge electric fence.
So you have described this conflict because of the increasing human infrastructure, civilization expanding, stretching across places that have been more wild in the past. But I would imagine there has always been human conflict with elephants in these same regions, just less of it, and the farms were able to somehow survive?
That's correct. So here in Kenya, where I live and work, you know, in the late 1970s, the human population was around 12 million, and we're now almost 50 million. So it's more than quadrupled in the last 30, 40 years. So we're talking a really, really rapid increase in the human population in an area where elephants have actually reduced in number. So this conflict is increasing very fast. It's becoming more and more aggressive. And of course, the retaliatory systems are improving as well. So there's more weapons out there. We have an issue. We're very close to Somalia as well. So we have things like a proliferation of some weapons up in the north, which are coming in. Elephants are really suffering. And it's not just elephants. Elephants are such a keystone species, and they represent so much of the issues to do with wildlife-human clashes. They also really do provide and indicate where corridors are between protected areas. And other animals do use those sites. But elephants are such a flagship species that it's important to understand and study this human-elephant conflict in order to really help other species that are going through the same issues, but may not be as sort of dramatic and interesting to politicians and also to communities at large.
And you mentioned electric fences, and this goes back in my mind to what I was talking about a little earlier about reserving certain areas as wilderness areas. I'm guessing that that's not working.
You know, electric fences are definitely one option. We can't rule them out. They are used effectively in certain areas, particularly where I'm based in Kenya. I'm in next to Tsavo National Park. They had to put an electric fence around the actual town itself, the city center, so you wouldn't have elephants walking down the high street, you know, as people were shopping. So there are certain places where electric fences are actually critical. But what's worrying is if you enclose elephant habitats entirely by an electric fence, what happens is that elephant population rapidly increases and causes local habitat destruction. They need to move. If you trap elephants in a small area, they will devastate the trees, drink all the water, And it's very, very important that they move and continue to gather enough food and water for their very large bodies. They also need to mate and find new partners. So fencing in elephants into a small area is generally a disaster, and you end up having to do very dramatic things such as culling programs or contraceptive programs to keep the population low. So we're trying to avoid that. And Kenya doesn't have very many fenced in areas. We still have a very open population. We have elephants that roam over 20% of the country, but our national park system only covers 8% of the country. So we have a really big overlap between people and elephants in Kenya in particular. And this is representative of many countries in Africa too.
It wasn't long ago that here on our program, Constant Wonder, we were talking about other megafauna that need to move, particularly the wildebeest we were talking about.
Yes.
And so is there a comparison to be made here in the foraging of elephants and wildebeests? I know that the wildebeests are
absolutely
more numerous.
Absolutely. I mean, in Kenya at the moment, we have the wildebeest migration that's just ending. We've had over a million wildebeest just in the Masai Mara, one game reserve alone. So these animals are absolutely fabulous. If they were trapped in the Masai Mara, they would eat us out of house and home. They need to keep moving. There's not enough grass for them to survive, and they would die if they even stayed for a year. So we have to let these big megafauna move. It's how Africa's always lived. And don't forget, Africans have always lived with elephants and wildebeest and rhino. It's just about this new increasing population. We have to think of novel solutions to keep people and elephants in particular apart to a certain level, and it doesn't necessarily mean electric fences. And my real interest is actually looking at this toolbox of options of how can you keep elephants apart. Not every situation is going to be the same, but there are now a variety of ways you can keep them out, and I think this idea of our beehive fences is probably one of the best. So using honeybees and actually using this fear of honeybees that elephants have is this really novel and unique way to keep elephants out of farms.
This is fascinating that this would work. And I'm wondering to what extent, well, we need to figure out from you, with your help, how they work. It seems fairly straightforward. But then we are also probably going to have to figure out how this kind of a fence is different from an electric fence.
Well, my real interest is using actual natural behavior to understand how animals and animals interact with each other. So understanding that elephants could be scared of bees, it's really important to understand how they could be stung. So I studied elephants foraging in trees. I studied them around beehives, and I learned quite quickly that they can be stung. So elephants have very, very thick skin. It's why they're called pachyderms. It means a thick skin. And so they really can't be stung by a bee through the body of their skin. But where they can be stung is around the eyes, in the mouth, in the watery areas at the tip of the trunk. And you can imagine an elephant being stung up a trunk, how extremely painful it would be, but also how terrifying if the trunk was to swell up. So it would be a disaster. So what we know is also that elephants never forget. So they only need to be stung once in their life to remember the scary sound, the consequential sting of that bee, and they will never go near a beehive again. So we're relying on that elephant instinct about avoiding a threat that hurt them in the past. So it's a sort of negative conditioning, which enables us to use beehives to put around farms to keep elephants away. It's such a simple idea, but it's extraordinarily effective. And we've been trying this for over 12 years now, and it's really, really working.
Lucy King, this story of yours is full of optimism because I understand the farmers are now able to pursue their agriculture practically unmolested.
That's right. So we've invented, part of my PhD was inventing what we call now a beehive fence. And this is a very simple idea, but it's a series of beehives strung every 10 meters around a farm between two posts, and the hives are connected with a simple piece of wire that connects one hive to the next hive to the next hive until you've entirely encircled around a hectare of farmland. Now, if an elephant tries to push through, they never go near the beehive because we know they're scared of bees. What they try and do is push in between the two hives, and this simple piece of wire hits their chest and it causes the hives on either side to swing, releasing the bees, or at least releasing a lot of buzzing sound, which scares them away. So it's a simple system. The fence is cheap to make, and it doesn't actually have any electricity or any kind of moving parts. It's the elephant itself that triggers the swinging of the hives and releases the bees. So it's super effective. The farmers absolutely love it. They can manage it themselves. And of course, the added benefit is that you're providing a beekeeping service to the farmers, which is pollination service for his crops, but ultimately a production of honey, which is such a valuable food product everywhere in the world, but particularly in Africa, where it provides a really important sweet substance and an alternative to sugar. So it's kind of got a triple benefit, and that's why it's taking off so well.
And all of these benefits override that aggressiveness that we were talking about earlier. These African honeybees are kind of, I just can't imagine wanting my family, my kids on a farm to be very close to one.
It's such a good point. And of course, this is critical that you're introducing honeybees around a homestead. So we've got two things going on here. First of all, these are homes which are almost weekly being impacted by large 7-ton elephants. So they're already at threat, and they have a really serious situation where elephants can come in and knock down the house or even kill them. So compared to that threat, having a few bees is a lesser threat. But secondly, Africans are particularly fond of honeybees and honey production. It's a very important cultural food. So they're quite used to having bees around, and there's often beekeepers in the community. People are very well respected. So people do know about bees and not to stick a stick in the hive or let your kids go near them. So we're not introducing a new species, we're simply introducing hives in a new system around a farm. And of course, we train our farmers to be very careful with their livestock and kids, and make sure that their kids are not sort of messing around with the hives. So that's very much part of our program. But it's a lesser threat than elephants coming in every night and destroying your crops.
Now, I'm trying to imagine the configuration of fence lines here. It seems to me, is this a fair comparison, that the old mode, the old thought might have been, we're going to put a fence around the elephants, around a huge area, and instead we're going to enclose now smaller farm spaces. They are farms, they're big, but comparatively speaking, they're smaller. Is it because you're enclosing the farm that the elephants are still free to move elsewhere and have more of a rangeland?
That's exactly it. It's a really holistic approach to a really genuine problem. And instead of ignoring the farmer's plight, which is really quite serious, and we can't let humans get at risk from elephants coming into their farms. We don't want people to be injured. We don't want people to be killed. We want them to appreciate and tolerate elephants and, if possible, even enjoy having them in their lives. They're an incredibly important cultural species as well as everything else, and a very keystone species for habitat. So what we're trying to do is basically make people feel safe in their own home and safe in their own land without blocking corridors. So we have communities where we have this community I work in, we have 32 beehive fences around 32 of the worst affected farms. But the elephants can still walk between the farms. So if they're on their migration route or they're going to check out some trees or they found a female, they can still walk around. And the idea is to just make sure people are safe at nighttime in their farms. And it's not perfect. We have around an 80% success rate. So we're not 100% there yet. In fact, I don't think anything is 100%, but it's proving to be around 80% effective. And it's massively increased the tolerance and the perception of tolerance that our farmers have of elephants. And what's lovely is we've got a waterhole that's near the community, and we actually see people coming out now to just enjoy watching elephants when they're there, because they know they can go back to their home and be safe once they're back in their house. So there is definitely an interest in elephants, an educational tool that we can use, a sort of a tolerance that is growing. And I think that's incredibly valuable.
You said something about nighttime, and now my imagination is running wild. Are the elephants then active coming into the farms at night?
They only come in at night. So they would not be in the communities during the day. The communities are very strict and would chase them out very quickly in the day. So the only time we're getting conflict is at night. They come in typically from the national park or where they're migrating past around 5, 6, 7 o'clock. And then they try and get into the farms in the dead of night. And it's very scary. So the farmers are living in their simple mud huts, and these elephants are trying to break in the middle of the night. And then as dawn breaks, they quickly go back to the national park or back to their bush area because they know they'll be seen in the daytime. So we're dealing with a very, very high risk situation. And what's interesting is that bees are most active in the day. So we have never once had a beehive fence broken in the day, but mostly it's because elephants are coming at night and they're disturbing the hives at night. So we've been studying how bees are reacting at nighttime because this is the only interest that we have, is are they going to keep elephants away at night? And we're really amazed that it's been effective as it is. I mean, 80% is nowhere near what we thought, and it's just fantastic that it's up at that level.
80% success rate using this method?
Yes, exactly. So what I mean by that is if you have 100 elephants approaching your farm, the beehive fences have stopped 80 of those elephants. So 20% of the time, an elephant has broken through. And mostly it's because a hive is empty. So there's no bees when an elephant tries to get through. So we're just trying to now improve beekeeping skills in farmers to make sure as many hives as possible are full of bees. And that's your natural electricity to keep the elephants away.
And I have to ask, because you did mention that the bees come back to the hive at night, they're more active out and about during the daytime. What have you observed about once that wire is nudged by an elephant and then it tips the hive and then the bees, do they come out at night? I know they're going to make noise and it's the noise that scares off the elephant, but do they go far afield from their hive at nighttime?
Well, interestingly, they don't typically, but what happens is the guard bees will come out very close to the hive, maybe within a meter of the hive, because they don't want to get lost in the dark. Now, if they're within a meter of the hive and they have a sense of a very hot creature around, whether it's a human in a bee suit or an elephant approaching, they will go and swarm and cling to the hot object. As a beekeeper opening a hive, you will find that you get bees at night clinging to you. It's very disturbing and you're in a bee suit. Imagine an elephant having maybe 10,000 bees swarming on him at nighttime. He will freak out and run away. So we know for sure that that bees can come out at night, but they don't swarm very far. So if they wouldn't necessarily chase an elephant for several kilometers like they would in the daytime, but it's enough to disturb the elephant as they try and break into the farm. It's very interesting behavior. So we're learning a lot about elephant behavior, but also honeybee behavior. And it's pretty complicated doing all this in the dark.
I just have to ask if you then have suited up to go be with the bees as well as being with the elephants.
Yes. Many times. So we do so many different experiments, not only the different designs of the fence, but harvesting as well, harvesting honey. Sometimes we've had problems with the hives, trying to see if there's some pests or parasites in there. So we have to suit up, and we help the farmers with harvesting and checking the hives as well. So I have a research camp, and we have a big internship program. So we have lots of Kenyan and international students coming to help us. We have beekeepers coming to help us and do training. So there's a constant sort of interaction with our hives and with the elephants, and a lot of it is at night. So it's pretty risky. It's not a cushy job that we have. It's quite hard work, but it's and I've been stung far too many times to want to remember, to be honest.
Lucy King is the head of the Human-Elephant Coexistence Program for Save the Elephant. She was speaking there with Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. We think of the trials of George Washington and the American Army at Valley Forge as being the anvil, so to speak, on which the American Revolution was forged. Forged not in fire, but in ice. But the following winter, 1778 to 79, may actually have been worse. That story coming up on Constant Wonder. If you like what you're hearing here on Constant Wonder, check out our archives. All of our shows can be found online at byuradio.org/constantwonder.